I'm your brother Fire Mary Diesel Ogaya, and welcome to the Class War Battlefield Podcast. When I started this show in 2011, my goal was to inform. Obviously, the show has evolved, a lot of new topics, a lot of new thoughts, taking on metaphysics, some spirituality, hitting you with all types of things that you may have never heard of, and some that you have. It's always lively. But now I'm coming to you to ask you to help me prolong this podcast. For years, I have been producing this podcast for free on your behalf. I am now coming to you to ask you to support this work. $2, $5, $10, $20, $50, whatever you can do, please do.
And now, the definition.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israel's army has ordered 1.1 million civilians in the northern Gaza Strip to evacuate southwards within just 24 hours from last night, an order the United Nations called impossible without devastating humanitarian consequences. The ultimatum came as Israel massed troops, tanks, and armored vehicles in southern Israel for a widely anticipated ground invasion of Gaza. On Friday, Israel dropped thousands of leaflets across the Gaza Strip, warning Palestinians to leave their homes or risk death. The Norwegian Refugee Council condemned what it called the collective punishment of countless civilians, among them children, women, and the elderly, which it said would amount to the war crime of forcible transfer, unquote. Israel's ultimatum came as its unrelenting bombardment of Gaza continued for a seventh day. This is 14-year-old Janan Alatar, whose uncle was killed and whose family was left homeless by Israeli airstrikes.
It was my sister's wedding, and we were making sweets when the airstrike started. So we left the house. We were packed on top of each other in the car, and we drove directly to the school here. But living in the school is not nice. And my uncle went back to the house, and they bombed it while he was there, and he was killed.
Health officials in Gaza say at least 1,500 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli strikes, including 500 children. Israel reports it dropped 6,000 bombs on Gaza during the first 6 days of the assault. Hospitals are overwhelmed with the wounded and dead and increasingly rationing fuel to operate life-saving medical equipment. Human Rights Watch has confirmed reports of Israel firing white phosphorus munitions during attacks on Gaza and along its border with Lebanon. White phosphorus poses a high risk of excruciating burns and lifelong suffering. Its use as an incendiary weapon in civilian areas is a war crime. Israel denies using white phosphorus. Israel previously used white phosphorus in attacks on the Gaza Strip, including in 2009. Thousands of residents of southern Lebanon have fled their homes near Israel's border amidst fears that cross-border skirmishes between Israel and Lebanese militants could escalate into a war. The exodus continued Thursday as Iran's foreign minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian traveled to Beirut, where he met with Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah. Iran has warned the war risks spreading to other fronts if Israel keeps bombing Gaza. Hamas's armed wing, the Al-Qassam Brigade, says 13 of the hostages it took during its weekend attack in southern Israel were killed by Israeli strikes on Gaza over the past day. Meanwhile, Israeli relatives of those slain and kidnapped by Hamas are reeling from the ongoing tragedies. This is Anat Moshe Shoshani, whose grandfather was killed and grandmother taken hostage by Hamas during a raid on their home at their Nir Oz kibbutz.
She's a 72-year-old woman. She's sick. She has heart issues. She watched her husband die right in front of her. And right after, they got her on the motorcycle. And she had to hold the terrorist that just murdered her husband. They were together for over 50 years. They build the kibbutz with their own hands.
Hamas has killed over 1,300 Israelis and taken about 150 hostages. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken visited Jordan today for talks with King Abdullah and Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas. Blinken will also visit Qatar, Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and Egypt over the weekend as he looks to secure the immediate release of hostages held by Hamas. His trip came after U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin said the Pentagon is not placing any conditions on its weapons shipments to Israel.
This is a professional military led by professional leadership, and we would hope and expect that they would do the right things in the prosecution of their campaign.
Austin spoke Thursday from NATO headquarters in Brussels. Today, he's in Tel Aviv, where he pledged ironclad U.S. support for Israel during a press conference with Defense Minister Yoav Gallant. The French government has banned all rallies in response to the Israeli bombardment and total blockade of Gaza. On Thursday, police in Paris used tear gas and water cannons against pro-Palestine protesters who gathered despite the prohibition.
Unfortunately, we were not able to protest properly because the demonstration was banned, while those in favor of the Israeli cause were authorized. This is not normal under the rule of law.
In the United Kingdom, activists have vowed to take legal action if officials ban the Palestinian flag. British Home Secretary Suella Braverman has urged police forces to use the full force of the law against protesters waving the Palestinian flag, which she said may not be legitimate if it's found to be a sign in support of, quote, terrorism. In Australia, human rights defenders are warning of the government's escalating repression against actions in support of Palestine. New South Wales Acting Police Commissioner Dave Hudson said officers won't need a reasonable cause to search protesters who attend marches planned in Sydney this weekend.
I urge people considering entering the city on Sunday to reconsider. There are a number of peaceful alternatives for people to voice their opinion in relation to the conflict that's currently going on in Israel and Gaza.
Here in New York, Columbia University closed its campus to the public Thursday in response to two separate demonstrations led by pro-Palestine and pro-Israel student groups. In Massachusetts, the names and photos of several Harvard students who signed a pro-Palestinian letter were displayed on a billboard truck on campus Wednesday with a banner that read, "Harvard's leading anti-Semites." Some of their names and personal information were also posted online. They were doxed. That action was organized by the ultra-conservative nonprofit Accuracy in Media.
The war continues in Israel between Israel and Hamas. You have Israel saying that the folks who live in Gaza, they should, 1.1 million people should leave Gaza. A lot of people saying, wait a minute, this is going to cause even more problems, saying that how do you just move a million people out of the way? President Joe Biden gave a speech today in Philadelphia where he did talk about what is happening there in the Middle East. Check this out.
I also want to say a word about the situation in Israel. The more we learn about the attack, the more horrifying it becomes. More than 1,000 innocent lives lost, including at least 27 Americans. These guys make they make Al-Qaeda look pure. They're pure evil. As I said from the beginning, the United States, make no mistake about it, stands with Israel. The United States stands with Israel. Secretary of State Blinken was in Israel yesterday, and Secretary of Defense Austin is there today. We're making sure Israel has what it needs to defend itself and respond to these attacks. It's also a priority for me to urgently address the humanitarian crisis in Gaza. At my direction, our teams are working in the region, including communicating directly with the governments of Israel, Egypt, Jordan, and other Arab nations and the United Nations to surge support and humanitarian consequences for Hamas attack to help Israel. You know, we can't lose sight of the fact that the overwhelming majority of Palestinians had nothing to do with Hamas and Hamas's appalling attacks, and they're suffering as a result as well. This morning, I spoke with the family members of all those Americans who are still unaccounted for on a Zoom call for about an hour and 10, 15 minutes. They're going through agony, not knowing what the status of their sons, daughters, husbands, wives, children are. You know, it's gut-wrenching. I assured them my personal commitment to do everything possible to return every missing American to their families. We're working round the clock to secure the release.
So, Matt, Michael, I want to go to you. Michael, I'll start with you first. This is, it is just it's interesting watching all of these different things unfold. I saw a post earlier that I thought was kind of interesting. Give me one second. I want to mention this, where Axios had this story that the State Department has said there's certain things that cannot. So here it is. It says, Scoop, this is a senior foreign correspondent for HuffPost. Hours after Israel ordered an exodus in Gaza, State Department officials circulated internal warnings against three phrases: de-escalation, ceasefire, end to violence, bloodshed, restoring calm. Why in the hell would we want not those things discussed?
So I'm not certain why. I know we have multiple things taking place at the same time. Okay. I'm glad President Joe Biden talked about the humanitarian crisis going on in Gaza, because to be quite frank with you, from looking at mainstream media, it appears they value the lives of Israelis more than they value the lives of the 2.2 million Palestinians living in the Gaza Strip. And they are living under like segregation-like conditions or oppression coming from Israel, okay? You have Israel dropping leaflets into Gaza saying for a million Palestinians to leave Gaza, but they really don't have anywhere to go for a million of them to leave. Even though some of them are trying to leave, they're trying to go south, they really don't have anywhere for a million to go. This is, I was talking to somebody earlier today about this. This looks like this is about to be another crusade, which was started out in 1096 AD between the Christians and the Muslims, okay, over control of the of what they call the Holy Land in Jerusalem. This is about to be a bloodshed. Now, Joe Biden and quite frankly, the Biden administration, I think, got criticism early on by not having a full-throated distinction between the 2.2 million Palestinians who are being oppressed and Hamas, which is a terrorist organization. And what I mean by that is so much attention was on Hamas attacking Israel, but what was lacking was a history for about the past 56 years between Israel and the Palestinians, okay? And you have a humanitarian crisis going on in the Gaza Strip. One UN person or ambassador has referred to the Gaza Strip as an open-air prison. So now more information is starting to come out about what's taking place in Gaza. But this is going to be tremendous bloodshed coming.
Yeah. And here's the deal, Matt. I mean, this is the thing for me that is, I just sort of sit here and I'm go, what are we talking about here? The reality is this here. Death is death. And if the whole point of a ceasefire, the whole point of ending the violence is to prevent death. And I think what's happening is, and I saw a story earlier that talked about this here, there is such a lust, a thirst for retribution. And I get it. 5,000 rockets come raining down. You want to do that, but that's gonna lead to response, and then another counter response, and the counter response, and the counter response. And what we're talking about here is we're talking about people who are being shipped out and moved out. Hamas has controlled Gaza since an election in 2006. There hasn't been one since. So this notion that all the Palestinians stand behind Hamas, you heard Biden say that, that's not true. But there is this attitude of hell, just open the gates of hell and unleash everything. And you talk about mutual self-destruction. Or, sorry, mutual destruction. You fired me, I fired you, I fired back, you fired back, and then it never ends.
Yeah, and I think you asked a particularly astute question. Why are there internal emails saying we're not going to use terms like ceasefire and other things that seem to be the focus, should be the focus of anybody involved in policy or in defense, right, is staving off the number of lives that are lost. But I think if we look at it in the larger context of the fact that this particular conflict is the one that is most difficult for anyone in the United States of America to talk about for fear of being labeled one way or the other. You know, mainstream media, to Michael's point, is everything I've seen has been about nothing but the number of Israelis who have been lost. And you're exactly right. Death is death. It is abhorrent, no matter whose life is lost. But the reality is this geopolitical issue has hugely complicated origins and will continue to be complicated going forward. And even that lumping together of Palestinians with Hamas as though, you know, those aren't distinct contingencies, one of which may not be completely supportive of the other, with, you know, Palestinians not being Hamas, is crucially important. But we don't find that level of nuance in this conversation. And what I always find particularly difficult in this instance is, I mean, he's the president, so naturally he has to talk about the number of Americans lost. But I mean, when you have thousands of people dying, it seems that if America is involved in this conflict, our primary focus should be how do we stop more people from dying, rather than purely being in lockstep with one of the combatants, with Israel. And I think, you know, if that's the government's policy, then that's fine. But that should be overridden by all efforts to make sure that we don't have continued loss of life. So I think that the media has to be more truthful about how it's playing this and how it is portraying it. And I understand people's fear about not being anti-Semitic or any other kind of label. But if we don't talk about the issues and all of the attendant issues, honestly, then we can't meaningfully have conversations about how the United States can help make sure that people on both sides aren't losing their lives.
This is the homepage to HuffPost. Stunning U.S. memo, don't call for de-escalation in Gaza. Also, the Israeli president said all Gazans responsible for attack. I mean, seriously, I mean, how 2.2 million people in Gaza, Michael, how do you make the claim that, oh, they're all responsible for the attack? What this says, what it sounds like, oh, this just gives us license to destroy it all and everyone.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly what it is. You know, our sister, Dr. Joy DeGruy, who wrote Post-Traumatic Slave Syndrome, she talks about cognitive dissonance, and she talks about for you to dehumanize another people,
yep,
you have to put negative pejorative terms on these people to reduce their humanity, to then justify mistreating them. And this is what it appears is taking place now by trying to lump all of the 2.2 million Palestinians in, who Israel has been oppressing for years. Let's make that clear. OK, it's the same way African Americans were segregated and oppressed by white people here in this country. This is what's taking place now by the Israeli government. Now, I also make a distinction most of the time between what the government is doing and what the everyday citizens feel and what they're doing, because oftentimes, sometimes there's congruency, but oftentimes there's a disconnect between how the government is oppressing the people in another country and how the everyday citizens of that oppressive country, you know, act. But this is how you set up a people for mass extermination. You put negative terms on them in the media to then justify and reduce the desire for other nations to come to their aid. And lastly, there has also been a call from reports I've seen. I think New York Times had an article about this. There has also been a call for all of the Arab, I can't remember if they said Arab nations or Muslims, however they put it, to rise up as well. Okay. And once again, I think this is going to be another crusade, and it's going to be bloodier and more people dead than the previous 8 crusades.
We talked about the threat that Israel issued to Palestinians in Gaza, to 1.1 million people, telling them to just, you know, get up and leave their homes. Those who are going south, so from who are evacuating or leaving and complying with the Israelis, some of them were bombed. So, you know, you're in a lose-lose situation against the Israelis. And I want you to listen to this this journalist from Gaza as she tells it.
So, more updates about the evacuation that I've been talking about since the morning. Do you remember when I said that they push people to evacuate from the northern to the southern areas via a safe route, as they said? Okay, that was a trick. That was a trick. They targeted ambulances, cars, and buses in the road, and more than 150 people were killed until now, as I heard from other press and other journalists. So this is part three. They are playing with and on us. They told us this is a safe route. Innocent people took anything from their homes and went to the southern areas, and they killed them. They literally killed them. Literally, more than 30 ambulance cars until now reached the Shifa, and it's not ended. It's not ended yet. Many people are killed. Most of them are children. The scenes are really hard. I can't even imagine that I'm living this. I can't imagine that this is real. I'm losing my mind. I'm losing my life. Please do something. So.
Apparently, you know, she's Hamas, according to the media, and, you know, disgusting Zionist scum like Ben Shapiro and Jordan Peterson, who is, you know, constantly groveling and kissing Netanyahu's backside, and, you know, or RFK Jr., another Zionist scumbag. Apparently, she deserves it. She's a human shield for Hamas, just like everybody there. All the civilians, it's okay to butcher them, you know. I mean, these people, they already sound crazy now, these Zionists and these apologists for Israel. They already sound crazy and unhinged now. I can't imagine history being anything other than extraordinarily distasteful and looking very, very unfavorably upon them when that time comes. So, you know, their names are going to go down as, you know, apologists for genocide and just all round scumbags, really, really scumbags. This is the UN also evacuating, right? Because the Israelis kicked them out as well. Apparently, they're also Hamas.
NBC News can now report three convoys of what appear to be evacuees were just hit by Israeli strikes in Gaza. That's according to the Palestinian Health Ministry and also some of our own interviews. 70 people are dead. Only an hour. IDF said an extensive attack against military targets within Gaza was underway. This morning, Israel dropped thousands of leaflets in the north of the Strip warning civilians to go south. Quote, Gaza City has turned into a battlefield. Leave your homes immediately, read those flyers. The IDF told Gaza City residents they would refrain from touching an evacuation route until 8 p.m. That was just about 2 hours ago. Quote, no one knows where we're going, one Gaza resident told NBC News, but we're ready to run.
You have reality and then you have what Israel says. These are people in Gaza who are chanting that they're not going to evacuate, you know, that they would rather die than be humiliated by Israel and forced out of their homes again. You have to understand how disgusting this is. People in Gaza have already lost their original homes. That's why they're in Gaza, many of them. And now Israel is bombing their homes and telling them to leave again. Like, just, you know, you become a refugee, then you're again a refugee, or your son becomes a refugee. You know, you have multiple generations of refugees. It's never ending with them. Israel, it's never enough for them. There's never enough land. There's never enough Palestinians that they can kill. There's never enough, you know, wars that they can wage. It's never enough bombing raids on Syria or bombing raids on Gaza or raids into the West Bank. Everything Israel does is justified. Israel, they're the chosen people. And everything a Palestinian Palestinians do is terrorism. Yeah, we know the drill. Here you can see people from Egypt carrying supplies across. Because as I said, the Gaza Strip is right next to Egypt. So they're allowing some people to go across into Gaza and deliver aid. But of course, like I said, the Egyptian president, Sisi, he said in his speech a few days ago that Palestinians should not listen to the Israelis and not try to come into Egypt. Now, again, this is good and bad. The bad thing, obviously, is that people are being bombed. So, I mean, I really, you know, it's very difficult, or rather, I should say, it's very easy for anyone who's not in Gaza to tell people in Gaza, just stay there, you know, and it will be fine, or, you know, just stay there. And it's not easy for them. It's not easy. It's very difficult. So that's the thing. But the other quote-unquote good thing about this is that, you know, Israel should not be given any more ground. On the contrary, people, instead of going south, should be going north. The same goes for Syria. The same goes for Lebanon. They should be going in, right, and taking back the land and not allowing Israel to take more of Palestine or the Levant. Again, I'm going to show you just on the map here. The Israelis, they've had several plans before to ship Palestinians off to Latin America, for example. Like, again, look at the map. They actually wanted to take Palestinians from here and then ship them all the way to Latin America just to get rid of them. And another one of their plans is to put them in the Sinai here. But Sisi, the Egyptian president, told them, no, do not leave. Do not allow the Israelis to force you out again. And I really don't know what is going to happen in these next hours. It's very, very critical. You know, we are really going to see now in the next couple of hours how this war is going to manifest itself, whether it will escalate or not. You know, if the Israelis decide to pursue and undertake a ground invasion, you know, I can't imagine Hezbollah just sitting that out in today's day and age. You know, they have the means, they have the training, they have the knowledge, and they have the power to deal with Israel. And so does Hamas. You know, the Israelis, the last time they went into Gaza about a decade ago, they got like humiliated and severely, severely punished for that. Just like when they went into Lebanon the last time. And this is the reason why the Israelis don't go into Lebanon anymore. They haven't touched it since 2006 because Hezbollah executed sufficient deterrence. And when it comes to Gaza, the Israelis, all they do is they bomb it by air to actually go in by land. And if they do, if they really get pushed by Netanyahu, who's obviously has to do nothing except sit in his office, then I don't even want to imagine what's going to happen, because this is not the Hamas of 20 years ago. This is a completely different beast. This is a highly proficient guerrilla force, and they demonstrated this on October 7th.
As shocking as what's happening in Palestine right now is, it's really nothing new. This week, we've seen Palestinians get kicked out of their homes at gunpoint, tear gassed, shot and killed, arrested for absolutely no reason, and now Gaza is being bombed by the IDF relentlessly. But it's also important to remember that the Palestinians have been experiencing these things on a daily basis for the last 73 years. So to understand the true weight behind the spike in Israeli terrorism, we have to first understand the historical context, which is why we're speaking with Abby Martin, a journalist from the Empire Files who's reported extensively from occupied Palestine. Abby, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
So in the past week or so, the issue of Palestine has basically become the talk of the world. And, you know, there was this whole issue in Sheikh Jarrah, and then we saw the Israeli troops start firing into the Al-Aqsa Mosque. And now, just a week later, Israel is collapsing. They're bombing buildings in Gaza. I mean, can you give us an overview of how we got here?
Absolutely. And when you're looking at corporate media, of course, it always starts with the rockets and then, of course, the unequivocal declaration that Israel has the right to self-defense. You absolutely never hear about what precedes such rockets. And you absolutely never hear about the context, the overall analysis of, you know, the historical context that preceded all of this, right? And that continues to be ongoing. As you mentioned, Sheikh Jarrah, which is a neighborhood in East Jerusalem, mobs of extremist settlers that are armed, mind you, have been expelling Palestinians out of their homes that they've had for generations in this neighborhood. We've all seen the videos. They are very harrowing and horrifying. People being thrown out of their homes by force, all of their material objects being thrown violently out of their homes. You have settlers who are obviously from America in the yards of Palestinians saying, if I don't take this home, someone else will, so I have to take it. This neighborhood has been under assault for quite some time. These settlers have just been waiting for what they deem as a mandate from the Israeli courts that they've been fighting for decades to try to seize and expel these Palestinians from East Jerusalem. Now, I think the important context to this also is that East Jerusalem, just like the West Bank, is under brutal Israeli martial law. Military law forbids Palestinians from protesting, convening in groups of 10 or more, raising a Palestinian flag. All of these things are illegal under martial law. And so it is very brave that Palestinians are protesting, let alone resisting in the ways that we're seeing now. So, of course, Sheikh Jarrah was violently mobbed by these settlers, thousands strong, chanting death to Arabs and burn their memories. Palestinians peacefully resisted these mobs of violent settler attacks. And of course, soldiers showed up to brutalize them and violently suppress the protests. And of course, all the Israeli soldiers stand on the side of the settlers. Now then, you have worshippers, hundreds of worshippers in Al-Aqsa Mosque. This is the third holiest site in Islam, stationed in Jerusalem, praying during Ramadan. And then you had IDF soldiers storm the mosque, launch stun grenades and smoke bombs inside, tear gas as well, inside of the mosque, sent hundreds of worshippers to the hospital. This is a war crime, right? This is a war crime that what they did was actually tear gas and launch smoke bombs inside of the hospital after the worshippers were sent there. And then you saw harrowing footage of thousands of extremist settlers chanting, burn their memory again, erase their names, outside of the burning Al-Aqsa Mosque. This is a mosque that is ancient. It's 100 years older than the Notre Dame Cathedral. All of the historians were in mass uproar when the Notre Dame Cathedral was burning, and there is a quite deafening silence over the intentional burning and attacks on this ancient compound. So all of this preceded the rocket attacks. Hamas, the governing force in Gaza, of course, issued a statement saying, we will retaliate if these attacks continue. And I think Israel made a miscalculation here. I think that they thought that they could violently expel these Palestinians and commit this ethnic cleansing with zero retaliation. And that was a miscalculation on their part because, of course, we saw the rockets fired in response. And Israel, like it always does, issues a wildly disproportionate response, demolishing entire homes with sleeping families inside. And I just want to pose to viewers just this analogy, because I think it's really a stark analogy. Imagine a mob of armed Muslim extremists storming an ancient synagogue, chanting death to Jews. How do you think the media would respond to that? Or how about this? Imagine, let's say, a mob of Trump supporters that all were armed with weapons in an immigrant community in Texas, storming through the immigrant community, seizing people's homes and occupying them, violently throwing out the immigrants on the street. I can't imagine how liberal media would cover such a situation. So it really just shows you the extreme hypocrisy when it comes to media coverage of what's happening in occupied Palestine.
The Palestinian militant group Hamas has carried out brutal acts of terror against Israeli civilians, and Israeli and American leaders are always keen to tell us how dangerous and evil Hamas is.
The inhumanity of Hamas.
I have no sympathy for Hamas.
That keep shelling Israel with thousands of rockets and mortar shells.
But what if I told you that Israel helped create Hamas? Officially, Hamas, which is the acronym for an Arabic phrase meaning Islamic Resistance Movement, was founded in 1987 at the start of the First Palestinian Intifada, or uprising, against the Israeli occupation. But its roots were planted much earlier. The Hamas founder, Sheikh Ahmed Yassin, was a half-blind, disabled Palestinian cleric and member of the Muslim Brotherhood. The Brotherhood had been repressed by the Egyptians in Gaza prior to 1967, but once the Israelis invaded and occupied the Strip, they didn't just turn a blind eye to these Islamists, they encouraged them. See, the Israelis, especially right-wing Israelis, wanted to undermine the power of the dominant Palestinian political force at that time, the nationalist PLO, at the heart of which was the secular Fatah party of Yasser Arafat, their bête noire.
بغصن الزيتون في يدي وببندقية الثائر في يدي.
By empowering Sheikh Yassin and the Muslim Brotherhood, Israeli leaders thought they could divide and rule the occupied Palestinians, play them off against each other, secular nationalists against religious Islamists. So in 1978, when Yassin wanted to officially register his Islamic Association, which was basically the precursor to Hamas, the Israelis were only too keen to help. Yassin built and grew a network of Islamist social institutions across Gaza, including schools and clubs and mosques, and Israel helped fund some of those projects. Most American politicians have no clue about any of this, although the former Republican Congressman Ron Paul once made this point on the floor of the House.
Hamas was encouraged and really started by Israel because they wanted Hamas to counteract Yasser Arafat.
Arafat himself told an Italian newspaper, quote, Hamas is a creature of Israel. He even claimed that former Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin admitted as much to him, calling it a fatal error. Now, you might be wondering, why should I believe mad Ron Paul or the famously shady Yasser Arafat? Well, you don't have to. You can believe top Israeli and US officials who've basically owned up to all this. Brigadier Yitzhak Segev, for example, who was the Israeli military governor in Gaza, and later told the New York Times reporter that he helped finance the Islamic movement. The Israeli government gave me a budget, he said, and the military government gives to the mosques. Colonel David Hakam, who worked in Gaza in the late 1980s as an Arab affairs expert in the Israeli military, has admitted that the original sin was Israeli support for Yassin in the late 70s. But at the time, he has argued, nobody thought about the possible results. Well, Avner Cohen did. Cohen was the Israeli official who was responsible for religious affairs in Gaza for more than two decades, and who now says, quote, Hamas, to my great regret, is Israel's creation. Yeah. Cohen's words. He actually wrote an official report to his superiors in the mid-1980s, warning them not to play divide and rule in the occupied territories and calling on Israel to, quote, break up this monster before this reality jumps in our face. But no one else on the Israeli side really took the possibility of blowback seriously at that time. They never do, do they? Hamas has since killed far more Israeli civilians than any secular Palestinian militant group, and its leaders have been pretty viciously anti-Israeli and even anti-Semitic in their rhetoric. Sheikh Yassin would eventually be assassinated by an Israeli airstrike in Gaza.
Sheikh Yassin and its organization, the Hamas, are responsible to the killings of more than 400 Israelis. So the question shouldn't be why now. I think it should be why not before.
Why not before? Well, because before, Israel was actually nudging and winking at Yassin and co, building them up as a rival to Arafat's Fatah. The die was cast for blowback. Blowback, incidentally, that they decided to double down on when they assassinated Yassin.
You can hear the crowds chanting for Hamas, and any idea that this operation would actually suppress or diminish that organization seems to be ill-judged.
The inconvenient truth is that Hamas is in part a creature of Israel's own making, an enemy that Israel spent more than 20 years helping to build up, and then spent the next 20 years, the past 20 years that is, trying to bomb, besiege, and blockade out of existence. The three Gaza wars, fought by Israel against Hamas since 2008, killed around 2,000 Palestinian civilians and a dozen Israeli civilians. That's the real human cost of blowback. David Long, a former Middle East expert at the US State Department under Ronald Reagan, told journalist Robert Dreyfus, "I thought the Israelis were playing with fire. I didn't realize they'd end up creating a monster. But I don't think you ought to mess around with potential fanatics. It's a lesson both the Israelis and the Americans never seem to learn, though. And as usual, innocent people, in this case Palestinians and Israelis, continue to lose their lives as a result."
Tonight, the issues and the controversy. 1,000 people have gathered at the City College of New York for a town meeting with Nelson Mandela. Mr. Mandela, you're participating in what is a very old and honorable American tradition, the town meeting. And rather than waste any time with my questions, if they don't ask you good ones, I promise I will try to.
Those of us who share your struggle for human rights and against apartheid have been somewhat disappointed by the models of human rights that you have held up since being released in jail. You've met over the last 6 months three times with Yasser Arafat. Are these your models of leaders of human rights? And if so, would you want a Gaddafi or an Arafat or a Castro to be a future president of South Africa?
One of the mistakes which some political analysts make is to think that their enemies should be our enemies. Our attitude towards any country is determined by the attitude of that country to our struggle. Yasser Arafat, Colonel Gaddafi, Fidel Castro support our struggle to the hilt. They do not support it only in rhetoric. They are placing resources at our disposal for us to win this fight. That is the position.
Mr. Mandela, as I mentioned to you before the program, we also have some distinguished guests sitting behind us. One of whom, Mr. Henry Sigmund, together with two other Jewish leaders, came to Geneva to visit with you precisely because they were so concerned not only by the kind of thing that you just said before the break with regard to Yasser Arafat, with regard to Libya's Colonel Gaddafi, but also because of the support that you seemed at different times to give to the PLO. I would like to ask Mr. Sigmund to stand now for a moment and pose whatever question he would like directly to you. Mr. Sigmund?
I think I would be dishonest if I did not express profound disappointment with the answer that Mr. Mandela gave to the previous question, because it suggests a certain degree of amorality.
As far as Yasser Arafat is concerned, I explained to Mr. Sigmund that we identify with the PLO because just like ourselves, they are fighting for the right of self-determination.
Mr. Mr. Mandela. We have ripped through the first part of this broadcast extraordinarily quickly. There are still a number of issues that we have to take up with Mr. Mandela, not the least of them being sanctions by the United States against South Africa. We will continue with that in the Nightline segment of this broadcast. Just a quick break now. We'll be back.
You know, and speaking of double standards, I mean, Palestinian activists have been told forever that Israel isn't a racist country, its existence and its history isn't based on the hatred of Arabs, and that it's actually a super progressive country, and that it's the only democracy in the Middle East, so-called, that they respect LGBT rights and so on. But this totally clashes with what we're actually seeing and what you're describing just now. And, you know, you're also seeing people, Israelis, who are saying, oh, well, this is just, you know, the work of some extremists. They're dismissing it as extremism. But it really seems like this sentiment is mainstream in Israel. What do you think all of this that's happened in the last week, what do you think this really says about the political climate in Israel? And how widespread are these views?
I don't know many democracies that actually forbids 5 million residents, that it controls, you know, every aspect of their lives, prevents any sort of democracy for those 5 million residents, 3 million in the West Bank, 2 million in Gaza. So, I wouldn't call Israel democracy, but it is interesting also that they've been able to run with the narrative that they are LGBTQ friendly and that they're this egalitarian place that welcomes, you know, all religions to have a place there. I mean, look, with its foundation, Israel is a settler colonial state. It was founded, of course, in the immediate aftermath of World War II. And right after the foundation of Israel came the Nakba, which was the horrific ethnic cleansing that expelled almost a million Palestinians from their homes, razed 500 Arab villages. Those who didn't leave their homes were killed. Several years after that, in 1954, was the Prevention of Infiltration Law that basically said that any refugee trying to return would be, there was a shoot-to-kill order. They also talked about laying mines in the routes of returns for refugees. So this is an order that's still in place. Of course, the enemy has somewhat shifted. Of course, they shield themselves from being able to commit these crimes with Hamas, you know, now that Hamas is governing the Gaza Strip. But this has always been a rule that's been in place since the foundation of Israel. And Israel itself is a state that is founded on top of indigenous land. It's an ongoing settler colonial project that has been continuing for 73 years. And every single day, we see the settler colonial project continue to expand, continuing to annex the entire West Bank, continuing to throw people out of their homes in a violent fashion, and continuing to kill and imprison anyone that resists. And, you know, I think this can all be summed up by something that's in place in East Jerusalem, which is called the demographic law, which essentially says that there needs to be a 70% majority Jewish population in East Jerusalem. So what does that mean? What does that mean if the percentage goes above 30%? Well, it means that you need to kick those people out, right, and commit ethnic cleansing to keep that artificial majority of the Jewish population. And essentially, that is what the foundation of Zionism is. It's an artificial majority that's imposed violently. And it means that in order to keep that majority, you need to expel or kill the indigenous population that is threatening that majority. This is a apartheid regime. This is a genocidal colonial occupation. And it's just quite fascinating that it's somehow been able to shroud itself in the notion that it's a progressive state and a democracy. It's quite the opposite. And you even see like founders of the state of Israel. I mean, the first prime minister, Ben-Gurion, when you look at what his statements were during the foundation of Israel, he says, you know, we must expel the Arabs and take their places. This was an explicitly articulated sentiment across pretty much every leader of Israel, no matter how progressive the United States depicts them. I mean, look at Levi Eshkol during the 1967 war. He said, if we don't give them enough water, maybe their orchards will wither and yellow. And I think that that's a policy that they've obviously continued in place in Gaza, where people do not have clean, potable water and haven't for some time. It's a completely untenable situation. It's unlivable. And it's atrocious that people who call themselves progressive can actually bend over backwards and make the mental gymnastics to excuse this and somehow pretend that you can be progressive, except for the case of Palestine.
The Pope's morning mass was interrupted at one point by indigenous protesters demanding action on a long-standing issue. Protesters unveiled a banner that read, "Rescind the Doctrine." Now, that is a reference to the so-called Doctrine of Discovery, a 15th century edict that the church and governments used to justify their seizure of indigenous lands. The protesters were escorted out of the church, where they continued their demonstration outside. The Prime Minister and Pontiff are said to have discussed that centuries-old edict in their meeting this week, and Canada's Catholic bishops confirm they are working with the Vatican on a plan to address that issue. Neethu Garcha has more on the doctrine's devastating impact and the growing calls to rescind it.
Grand Chief Herb Norwegian says the way he and his people consume the land's resources is still dictated in large part by the doctrine of discovery.
It was a tool that they used to take land from un-Christian First Nations people.
The philosophy was used to legitimize the colonization of indigenous peoples around the world, dehumanizing, exploiting, and subjugating them of their most basic rights. Chief Norwegian says to this day, it informs Canadian and American government policies.
The United States government, the whole Constitution, is basically based on the doctrine of discovery.
The root of all evil is that doctrine of discovery, and it has to be rescinded.
Georgina Lightning and her daughter Crystal are raising awareness about the ongoing implications through a new documentary called The Doctrine of Recovery.
We need a female-driven story about this doctrine because, you know, all that it has done to us.
No more pretending. Our survival depends upon us caring for our life giver.
The film screened in Edmonton Monday, the same day the Pope failed to address the doctrine in his apology.
I hope that he acknowledges what has happened.
Without, you know, meaningful acts to follow through, it'll just be all for naught.
Elder Claudette Commanda says even after the Canadian government overtly rejected the doctrine by passing Bill C-15 last year, harmonizing the country's laws with the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, revoking the doctrine would help eliminate a layer of legal injustice.
Then the courts will no longer use this against us whenever we move forward to plead our inherent rights.
And she says the Pope has the power to take action.
500 plus years and there was one pope who made a doctrine of discovery. Well, let's fast forward to 500 plus years and well, this pope can make a change. He can revoke that doctrine of discovery.
The rest of the Canadian population need to be behind us and they need to do everything they can to support First Nations on their road to recovery.
Because he says the Pope telling a truthful narrative of the past can create a more hopeful narrative for the future. Neethu Garcha, Global News.
I was looking at this poll from Hebrew University in Jerusalem, which surveyed Israeli youth, and it said that 66% of Orthodox youth, 42% of religious youth, and 24% of secular youth, quote-unquote, hate Arabs, and 49% of religious youth and 23% of secular Israelis say they want to strip Palestinians of the right to vote. You guys at the Empire Files released a video called Everyday Israelis Express Support for Genocide, which the video kind of speaks for itself. I want to play a short clip for viewers. And by the way, these interviews were shot in a park called Tolerance Square in the Jewish quarter of Jerusalem. But here's the clip.
I think also that every Arab that doing a terrorism attack, we have to kill him, and not because he's an Arab. Because he's a terrorist. I think you should also kick out the family because it all begins with chinuch, how you say?
Education.
I don't think there's any answer to it.
Really?
There's only one way, like, I would carpet bomb them.
You would carpet bomb them?
It's the only way you could deal with it.
I think that we miserable, the Arabs make a big whim, and we need to kill the Arabs.
No. Okay.
We'll talk about this later.
And how God punished is the sins by other people. He said, he sent the Nazis, he sent, and now he sent Palestinians.
And I mean, these clips are almost prophetic in the way they sort of predict what's happening right now in Jerusalem. And what really amazes me is how nonchalant these people are. I mean, you hear people in the U.S. talk about, you know, being liberal Zionists and, you know, Zionism isn't racism, whatever. But everything we see coming out of Israel is just this ultra right-wing nationalism. And it doesn't really seem like anyone stands against it, or if they do, they're quiet about it, or they're being coerced into being silent. Is there any real opposition to this racism in Israeli society? And if so, how are anti-racist and left-wing groups perceived in Israel?
Well, even B'Tselem, which is a human rights organization that simply documents what's going on, is considered an enemy, right? The word leftist is actually a slur in Israeli society. And I think people have to wrap their minds around what even the notion of liberal Zionism means, right? It's kind of this pink-washed notion of what Zionism is at its core, which is a racist settler colonial state that mandates that millions of people are kept under colonial occupation, brutal occupation. And then, you know, of course, there's Gaza, 2 million people caged in this open-air prison. So the fact that liberal Zionists, they just kind of want to believe that they are progressive, but at the same time, they have to accept the reality of what Israel is. And they have to accept the reality of it's an exclusively Jewish state. What does that mean for the Arabs and the Palestinian population that live there? What's really the reality there is that there's this current of genocidal bloodlust throughout Israeli society. You can see this reflected in poll after poll. You can see it reflected in just the results of the elections, right? The vast majority of Israelis support the Likud government. They support Netanyahu. They support the ethnic cleansing. They support the ongoing massacres and atrocities carried out in Gaza. They support the ongoing occupation. And this is liberal Zionists as well. You see 80 to 95% support for things like the carpet bombing of Gaza in 2014, for things like the shoot to kill orders during the Great March of Return a couple of years ago in 2018. So these things are quite starkly reflected and quite obviously so. Of course, it's just not reported as such. When we were there in Jerusalem, which is supposed to be this very liberal safe haven for LGBTQ friendly people, there's gay bars, and it pretty much just feels like you're in like a somewhere in America, right? A bustling city. Well, we just picked random people from all walks of life. We didn't cherry pick any of these interviews. And we got very honest answers of what people just simply think about the situation. We left it a very open-ended question and let people speak for themselves. What I found interesting about it was, A, what would these people say when the camera isn't on? You know, the fact that they are very, very just kind of leapt into this rhetoric that was nothing short of genocidal was very alarming. And they knew that they were on camera, right? They knew that they were speaking to a Western audience, and they were completely unabashed with these kind of sociopathic viewpoints about what should be done with Palestinians and Arabs. So the people who didn't say, you know, obliterate them, kill them, bomb them into, you know, into oblivion, said things like they should all be kicked out, right? Or we should give them a state so then we can actually have a war and drop one big bomb and that's it. One other person that I found, you know, it was really disturbing. He said, we have the right to hate them. We should have the right to hate them. You had a young 17-year-old girl or so who looked like she was just, you know, a cute little cheerleader, basically giggling and saying, death to all Arabs. So this is something that is extremely common. I think that in order to be an Israeli living within 48, you need to condone this behavior to a certain extent. You need to be okay. You need to be brainwashed to the point that you actually are okay with the ongoing colonization, right? The ongoing apartheid regime that denies 5 million people their basic human rights. And I think the Israelis that are truly left-wing leave. They flee. I mean, people who are anti-Zionist, they can't stay in a Zionist settler colonial state. So a lot of these people have passports for other places in Europe, and they just leave because they can't exist in such a fascistic, racist society that is just committing these atrocities against other people. And so that's why you have the liberal Zionists living comfortably there, and they just tell themselves that this is all necessary for their security and safety. And you even saw people who called themselves liberal Zionists and leftists tell us on camera they want a more humane occupation. That's the liberal Zionist viewpoint, is the occupation is important, but it should be more humane.
And we are back once again at the City College of New York with Nelson Mandela. And Mr. Mandela, we have just heard a number of the things that you said in our hour between 10 o'clock and 11 o'clock this evening. Some controversial things, not the kinds of things necessarily that a very political man says. If you were very political, you might have been more concerned about not alienating some people in this country who have it within their hands, within their power, either to continue sanctions against South Africa or to raise those sanctions, to lift them. Why were you not a little more political? Perhaps we're too accustomed to politicians in this country.
I do not understand what you mean. Perhaps if you clarify what you are referring to, I may be in a position to comment.
What I'm saying is that in this country, for example, there has been for many years a close alliance between the Jewish population and the black population in the civil rights struggle. There is likely to be a rather negative reaction to some of the things that you have said. That reaction could very well cause people to call up their congressmen, their senators, and say, go ahead, lift the sanctions. Why not? After all, President de Klerk is doing a great deal against apartheid. Only today, in fact, his number two man, Gerard Viljoen, said that the government perceives itself in South Africa as being part of the anti-apartheid struggle.
As far as the Jewish question to begin with, I have had discussions at my own initiative with prominent Jewish leaders to straighten out this affair. Amongst the people I saw was Mrs. Helen Suzman, who has been an MP in our country for more than 30 years. There was Mr. Mazens, who has been a judge in Lesotho, Botswana, and the old Rhodesia. There was the chief rabbi of Johannesburg. There was Professor Katz from the University of Witwatersrand and an eminent community leader in South Africa. We discussed this question and all misunderstanding was cleared, the question of Yasser Arafat and the PLO. I have also discussed the question with the Jewish leaders in the USA and very top people like Mr. Sigman. We reached an agreement on this question and we saw eye to eye. Now, I don't know where your concern arises. The Jewish leaders themselves are able to determine their own affairs. Nobody else is entitled to say that the Jewish leaders are going to be concerned about your stand. Because I have had the discussions with them, and those discussions will reach consensus. But there are matters, of course, in which we did not agree. The position which we take as the ANC, I thought we were able to explain it in such a way that it removed the concern of the Jewish community.
Let's broaden it up.
I am still prepared to do that even in this talk. If the Jewish leader have any doubts about our stand, I am prepared to address them and to allay their concern. Because they are a very important community both in South Africa and of course in the States. And I'm prepared to iron out any differences that might exist. But they must know what our stand is. Arafat is a comrade in arm, and we treat him as such. We have many Jews, members of the Jewish community in our struggle, and they have occupied very top positions. But that does not mean to say that the enemies of Israel are our enemies. We refuse to take that position. You can call it being political or a moral question, but for anybody who changes his principles depending on whom he is dealing, that is not a man who can lead a nation. Apparently, Mr. Koppel, you have not listened to my argument. If you have done so, then you have not been serious in examining it. I have replied to one of our friends here that I have refused to be drawn into the differences that exist between various communities inside the USA. You have not commented that I am going to offend anybody by refusing to involve myself in the internal affairs of the USA. Why are you so keen that I should involve myself in the internal affairs of Cuba and Libya?
No.
I expect you to be consistent. I don't know if I have paralyzed you.
No.
I want to take a step back here a little bit and talk about how we got here, because this really isn't anything new. You know, as you alluded to, Israel was created out of land theft. It couldn't exist without stealing Palestinian land. And in fact, the day Israel marks as its Independence Day is known by Arabs as Al-Nakba, which translates to the catastrophe. It's coming up on the 15th of May. It was a long campaign of land theft and outright massacres of entire villages. I mean, they literally erased hundreds of Palestinian villages and replaced their Arab names with Hebrew names. But I think the really damning piece here is that the Zionist movement, which was the movement to create a Jewish state on top of the Palestinians, openly stated its intentions to ethnically cleanse Palestine. I mean, they openly collaborated with European colonizers like Cecil Rhodes and Winston Churchill. They spoke about Arabs as if they weren't even human beings. I mean, can you tell us about the racist history of the Zionist movement?
That's, you know, that's really at its core what Israel is. It was founded on this kind of racist colonization that still continues, and they've masked it in something else entirely, but at its core, from the very foundation of Israel, that's exactly what it has been. And, you know, as I mentioned, this has been articulated by pretty much every ruler of Israel since the foundation. The Nakba was an extremely horrific event, but the Nakba is particularly important because, you know, the 500 villages that were razed, a lot of these people were expelled into refugee camps, not only in Palestine, but in neighboring countries. You know, that's why a lot of the people actually fled to Gaza. And that's why 75% of people in Gaza are refugees from neighboring lands that they were ethnically cleansed from, right outside of this artificial border. And it's just a really horrific situation. I mean, the fact that generation upon generation, these refugees have just been left. And Israel has just been standing in flagrant violation of international law, because after the Nakba, after the catastrophe, the UN declared that Palestinians have the right to return. That's why Palestinians are seen holding the key. The key is a very symbolic image for them, because they believe that they have the right to return. Millions of Palestinians do have the right to return under international law to these homes. When we spoke to Ahmed Abu Artema, the lead organizer of the Great March of Return, he said the intent of the Great March was to kind of show the international community, you know, mount this peaceful occupation in tents and encampments to show the international community that they are still refugees, to bring attention to their plight as refugees, and say, hey, 70 years later, we're still refugees without a home, and we still have nowhere to go, and we're still being treated like animals. And it was meant to just be a symbolic gesture. And of course, we all know what happened next, which is they were met with sniper fire. Hundreds were massacred in cold blood for simply peacefully resisting. And it really shows you that it doesn't matter what they do. It doesn't matter if they're peaceful or armed or anything. Israel will react in the exact same way. And they've even gone as far as criminalizing peaceful resistance and activism outside of Palestine, which is why you see all of these anti-BDS measures in 30 or so states here in the U.S. But yes, I think from its very core, Israel is a racist colonizing entity, and it continues to be so.
Kenyatta, what's up?
Well, I have a pretty serious statement I want to make, and I want to make it as sensitively as I possibly can, Tom. You know, we have hotspots, if you will, all over the world right now. Burkina Faso, Niger, Mali in Africa, or El Kebulon. We have the situation in Ukraine. We have what's going on in Israel. The world's a hot mess right now. And when I say what I'm about to say, I am not indicting white people. None of us are responsible for our ethnicity or how we look or our gender. But this conversation has to be elevated, because white supremacy has nothing to do with what an individual looks like. White supremacy is a state of mind, and I know that you are aware that I've talked about this many times. And as one of our greatest thinkers, and I'm talking about you in this country, you know, let's damn the politics, Tom. I don't have any politics. I have the politics of humanity. But if you look at all of these situations, if you take out the element of white supremacy, my question is, do they exist? They don't. They don't.
Give me an example.
Take out the element.
What you're talking about.
If you take out the element of white supremacy in Mali and Burkina Faso and all those hotspots in Africa, you do not have those situations. If you
I thought the wars in Mali were between essentially black people, between Africans.
They are, but they are a result of colonialist coming in taking resources.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm getting.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I get what you're saying.
If you look at the situation between North and South Korea,
if you take out the element, I'm not talking, again, I'm not talking about individuals.
Right.
If you take out the element of white supremacy, does it exist?
Korea has historically been a nation separate from, you know, the other Asian nations around it. The Koreans consider themselves a race separate. That's not what I'm getting at. Colonialism.
I'm not getting at that, Tom. I'm talking about the fact that when the United States came in, it was, you know, the Korean Peninsula was one. It was Korea.
Yeah.
Now you have North and South. You have the same situation in Israel. You know, when I look at the situation in Israel right now, or Palestine, however you want to look at it, depending on perspective, when I look at that, I mean, as a black person in the United States, I look at that and I'm seeing the white supremacist element. You can't not see it. And that is why so many black people in this country, that at least the ones that I know, we have some empathy for the Palestinians, because we see things differently. Now, understand that Europeans, also known as white people, are 12% of the world's population. You can't kill us all. Again, I'm not trying to individualize this. I know I'm talking to one of a person that is a person I admire. I would admire you no matter what you look like. I'm not indicting people because of what they look like. I'm talking about the state of mind. And my question is to you, if you took this element out of white supremacy, I'm talking domestic politics. You talked about it in your preamble for the show. If you took that element out, would the world be in as dire a shape it is right now?
Oh, I think the answer is clearly no. I agree with you.
No, it would not. And that yeah. And that's what I'm hoping.
Yeah,
no,
from the doctrine of discovery forward. Yeah, absolutely. And long before that, for that matter, but yes.
And that's what I want for humanity to get to.
Yeah.
That's what has to be stamped out. That has to be stamped out.
The bitter struggle between Arab and Jew for control of the Holy Land has caused untold suffering in the Middle East for generations. It is often claimed that the crisis originated with Jewish emigration to Palestine and the foundation of the State of Israel. Yet the roots of the conflict are to be found much earlier, in British double dealing during the First World War. This is a story of intrigue among rival empires, of misguided strategies, and of how conflicting promises to Arab and Jew created a legacy of bloodshed which has determined the fate of the Middle East.
During the First World War, the British, the French, and the Russians had these secret plans to carve up the Ottoman Empire, because they believed that would balance out their imperial ambitions, but tough luck for the Turks, the Arabs, and anyone else who got in the way.
Certainly, all the seeds were planted then, in the sense that it was the British who promised the Arabs independence on the one hand, and a Jewish homeland on the other, and you could not simply reconcile one with the other.
The British scattered promises to anyone who might be of some use to them without thinking about the consequences. So British duplicity, British double dealing, went a long way to perpetuate the conflict in Palestine.
At the end of the day, when you're fighting a war, you are very liberal in what you're offering in terms of a post-war settlement. When you get down to the conference table, when the war has ended, and you have to start honoring your agreements, you then have to decide what's in your interest or not. And the British saw the Middle East as a western flank for their power in India and their power in Asia in general.
The story of Britain's involvement in the Middle East and the ensuing struggle between Arab and Jew begins with her colonial past. At the beginning of the 20th century, King Edward VII ruled over a vast empire with interests in every part of the world.
India became increasingly important because it was the second pillar of British power in the world. Moving the Indian army about was extremely important in extending British interests and British influence across the globe. And the Suez Canal was, of course, the quick way to do that. It's very important for the British geopolitical position to ensure the Suez Canal remains safe and secure.
With this aim in mind, Britain had become the only European power to establish a major foothold in the Middle East, in the principalities around the Persian Gulf, in Aden, and in Egypt. Britain had annexed Egypt from Turkey's Ottoman Empire in 1882, and by the time it was made a protectorate in 1914, Cairo had become the center of British power in the Middle East. The presence of imperial troops in the region was of vital strategic importance, for the Ottoman Empire under Sultan Mohammed V was in alliance with Britain's much-feared rival, Germany. Together with the Austro-Hungarian Empire, these countries made up the Central Powers, and pitted against them were the three allies, Britain, France, and Russia. From the Ottoman capital, Constantinople in Turkey, the Sultan ruled over the last of the great Islamic empires. It had been in almost terminal decline for decades. Yet the fate of the Ottoman Empire was to be sealed by the outbreak of the First World War in August 1914. In Europe, Germany's rapid advance was halted by Britain and France along the Western Front. In the east, Russia's war against Germany and Austria-Hungary also reached deadlock. The powerful weapons of the industrial age were killing thousands of men in the trenches of every army.
All of the leading powers expected the war to be over within a matter of months. So in that sense, all of them are surprised at the end of 1914, when not merely is the war going on, but it shows every sign of being likely to go on for a very long time. At that point, they begin to think about new ways of winning the war.
Britain's Prime Minister Asquith felt that with the stalemate in Europe, it was essential to widen the conflict. Together with Foreign Secretary Lord Grey, Minister for War Lord Kitchener, and the First Lord of the Admiralty Winston Churchill, they masterminded a complex strategy to undermine the Central Powers.
This was a global war, and the British saw the Middle East very much in a global context. The traditional British preference for sideshows, as people unfavorably call it, the indirect strategy, the way of attacking the soft underbelly, as Churchill called it, of the enemy, and the soft underbelly was seen to be Turkey.
Britain's secret plan involved, on the one hand, a military diversion, and on the other, a devious use of diplomacy through bribery, subversion, and double dealing. All these devices focused on the enemy's weakest link, Turkey's Ottoman Empire.
Diplomacy in general has always had a secret dimension to it, but where discretion ends and conspiracy begins is an open question. But during the period up to and during the First World War, there was a particularly intense set of negotiations and discussions between the major imperial powers, between the French, the Russians, and the British in particular, cutting in the Italians as well, about what would they do when the war was over and when the Ottoman Empire broke up.
The British government hoped that by striking a deal over the spoils of war, it would strengthen the alliance against the Central Powers. Amongst the Allies, Russia had long sought access to the Mediterranean. In a secret treaty of March 1915, Britain and France offered what was to the Tsar a prize of vital geopolitical importance, Constantinople.
It is their key outlet into the wider world and into the Mediterranean. And it is the one thing, of course, the British and the French have been attempting to prevent the Russians from achieving. So this is a complete volte-face. This is the British, the French and the Russians coming to an agreement over something which was, up to this point, almost inconceivable.
Italy's King Vittorio Emmanuel was another target for bribery. Britain, France and Russia tried to tempt Italy, a pro-German state, to join the Allies. In April 1915, a secret treaty offered Italy a substantial bit of Ottoman real estate in Anatolia.
Again, it's another power coming into the equation and being offered territorial advancement, which in normal circumstances would have been quite inconceivable.
The bribe worked. Italy joined the Allies and declared war on the Central Powers in August 1915. But Britain's strategy to undermine the enemy via the Ottoman Empire also required subversion. By using domestic opposition to weaken, maybe even destroy it, Britain exploited a new movement sweeping through the empire, nationalism.
Nationalism, in the sense of believing that there are peoples with a clear cultural identity and that these people should live independent, that idea spread to the Middle East as to other parts of the world in the latter part of the 19th century. So you had the beginnings in the Ottoman Empire of a Turkish nationalism.
This came to a head when the Young Turks took power in a coup in 1908 and started to impose their language and culture on the Arabs of the empire. But this only reawakened an interest amongst Arabs in their own heritage. A thousand years before, Arabs had brought the technology and literature of the East to the West, and their religion, Islam, had encompassed much of Asia, North Africa, and southwestern Europe. The idea of recovering that historic grandeur had remained in the consciousness of Arab intellectuals. By the start of the First World War, the antagonism between Arab and Turk had increased.
The very fact that the Turks were saying, we want to have a unified empire, meant the Arabs said, wait a minute, we're not part of this. So all of this literary and nationalistic revival then took a much more political form, and therefore you got the emergence of Arab nationalism.
They had arrived at the conclusion that remaining in the Ottoman Empire was becoming hopeless, that they couldn't actually share power with the Turks. And they began thinking of having their own state.
By the summer of 1915, British intelligence confirmed that the Arab nationalist movement was the breakthrough the government was looking for. Britain and her French ally dispatched officers to sound out Arab leaders.
Both the French and the British started, you could say, seducing various local Arab leaders, that if you side with us, we'll give you your independence. So why don't you leave the Ottomans? And various people were tempted as a result. If they thought they could actually gain independence, why not side with the Europeans against the Ottomans?
The idea was to tempt the Arabs into a revolt against their Ottoman overlords and create a diversion which would tie down the Central Powers in the Middle East. Ironically, the impetus for such a diversion had come not from London, but from the Arab world. In the Hejaz, in Western Arabia, Sheriff Hussein, its ruler, was set on extending his political and geographical domain. He believed he might be able to do it with the help of the British. In turn, the British were impressed by Sheriff Hussein's family credentials as custodians of the holy places of Islam.
They call themselves Hashemites. They call the family Hashemites because that's the family or the tribe of the Prophet Muhammad. They were the Bani Hashem, the sons of Hashem. So he was, Sharif Hussein was the leader of the Hashemites. He was the person responsible for Mecca and Medina. And although he had worked with the Ottomans before the First World War, once the First World War happened, he saw this was his chance.
A chance too for the British, who saw support for Sharif Hussein as a way to threaten the Sultan's hold on the Caliphate, the political leadership of the Islamic world.
The British, because they were fighting the Ottomans, and the Ottomans were claiming to be the real representatives of Islam, they wanted a counterforce. And the counterforce was represented by Sharif Hussein, being a descendant of the Prophet. But Sharif Hussein was speaking of liberating Arab lands, building a new national state. He wanted to be king of the Arabs, not simply of Arabians.
In July 1915, Sharif Hussein smuggled a message to the British High Commissioner in Cairo, Sir Henry McMahon, offering to raise a substantial Arab force against the Ottomans in return for British support for Arab independence. In the ensuing secret correspondence between the two men, Sharif Hussein was given to understand that he could expect British support in achieving some of his ambitions in the event of an Ottoman defeat. This letter of October the 26th, 1915, outlined the main points of the arrangement.
The actual document itself is absolutely riven with ambiguity. There's no doubt about that. The question is whether Hussein recognises that. My sense of Hussein is that he does recognise it. In other words, there is no wool being pulled over his eyes, because he's perfectly aware that if he's going to create a modern Arab empire, he's going to need some logistical, economic development, and that can only come from the outside world.
Taking Britain's assurances of support at face value, Hussein, together with his sons Faisal and Abdullah, amassed a sizable force. The new army was commanded by the young and charismatic Faisal, who had captured the imagination of the Arab masses in the quest for Arab independence. Yet even as Hussein and Faisal mobilized their troops, the British were preparing to sell them short. Back in London, in the spring of 1916, Britain was negotiating with France about the future shape of the Middle East. Behind closed doors, Sir Mark Sykes of the British Foreign Office had been meeting his French opposite number, François-Georges Picot. Britain knew it was vital to offer the French a stake in the spoils of the Ottoman Empire, should they win the war.
There was an awareness on the British side that they had made such huge sacrifices that one couldn't just ignore French ambitions, and that the French were determined to have their historical piece of the Levant.
Poring over a map of the Levant, Sykes and Picot personally drew in the areas they wished to see under their control. Their secret deal amounted to the virtual carve-up of the Middle East. In Area A for the French and Area B for the British, the imperialists intended to exercise power indirectly. They would appoint advisors and take charge of the finances in their respective spheres of influence. Then there was the area coloured blue, which was to be directly controlled by France. This included what was then known as Greater Syria, where the French traditionally had commercial and religious interests. As for the area coloured pink, known as Iraq, with its strategic ports, railways and oil, this was to be under British rule. The area coloured yellow represented Palestine and was envisaged as an international zone, except for Haifa.
What the British wanted was the oil of Iraq, and they concentrated on getting Iraq and getting away from Iraq to the Mediterranean in order to transport this oil. So they got Haifa on the Palestinian coast, and they got most of Iraq.
The Sykes-Picot agreement was a pretty shameful document, and I wouldn't attempt to defend it. but it was drawn up by people who were sort of operating under the old kind of balance of power considerations in an imperial frame of mind.
Storm is rising against a privileged minority of the earth.
This is why I say it's liberty or it's death. It's freedom for everybody or freedom for nobody.
This is an NBC News Hotline special report.
We're at a turning point in the history of this nation. We need to stand for freedom. There's an escalating authoritarianism and even a creeping fascism. Freedom is precious. If we don't fight for it, you lose it.
This much is clear.
We must rebel.
This is our country. We have always lived in it. We were happy. Then you came. We have to protect ourselves. We have to save our country. We have to fight for what is ours.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. I'm your brother, Ryan D. Zoka, yeah? And welcome to this episode of the Class War Battlefield Podcast. No, welcome to this Class War Battlefield Podcast episode. That mix-up kind of highlights and underscores the emotions that I'm dealing with today on this particular episode. Why am I dealing with emotions on this particular episode this way? Well, for starters, this is going to be about war and some of my reflections on what has been taking place internationally over the last couple of years. Killing innocent people puts me in a certain mood, a very unhappy mood. When I witness groups targeting or killing innocent people, there is this reaction that I have deep in my gut. The first part of it is moralistic. It is deeply, 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 deeply sorrowful for the loss of life. Bound with that is a desire to refute these people drastically. And then there is a part that seeks to understand why this happened. Because through understanding why it happens, we may be able to prevent it from happening again. And that underscores really to a major point what my thinking has been about when I hear about all of these wars and all of these attacks on civilians, and understanding what led to the creation of this vacuum, which enabled this attack to be planned. Notice what I said. This vacuum that enabled this attack to be planned. Most people view it the opposite way. How was this vacuum created that which allowed for this attack to take place? Well, only if you are concerned with those who are under attack do you place yourself in that position to see only from the attacked, from those who have been attacked point of view. one of my top two Dr. Martin Luther King speeches, and it is the one that I often cite as my favorite, is his Beyond Vietnam speech, where he went through a process of trying to appreciate, trying to understand how the United States and Vietnam got to the point where both countries found themselves at in 1968. I first heard that speech in 2007, late 2007. I started listening to it repeatedly, literally, on repeat, in 2008. Probably listened to it 1,000 times that year. And I'm really not joking. Really, I'm not. Okay? Hearing Dr. King not only give a brief history leading up to the conflict in Vietnam, but also find sympathy with the soldiers who have gone over to fight, was a stunning revelation of how to approach conflicts. Now, to be honest, I had utilized the tactic of discovering what led to something happening in order to understand why something happened and if there was a way that it could be prevented or reconciled without further damage. So I knew that this could be utilized on a massive scale. I just had never heard anybody put it into action until Dr. King. Further, Dr. King was the first person that I heard articulate the idea that this means of investigating attacks and wars and conflicts was the only truest method of ensuring peaceful outcomes and peace altogether. Which, for me, was a double plus, because peace was always what I had my mind focused on. Whether you were talking in small atmospheres, you know, interpersonal relationships in the grassroots, or you were talking about larger arenas, peace was my goal. And I often sought, in everything I did, to make peace a part of my methods. I needed to let you know this because as I get further into this episode, you may forget that peace is my ultimate goal, because the statements I'm going to bring out will conflict sometimes with the mainstream narratives and the mainstream's desire and outcomes. To begin with, I want to speak about how I view the turn by some progressives or faux progressives towards not supporting Ukraine and being more favorable towards Russia. And I want to start there because this is one of the most controversial stances that exists presently in what is the so-called left. Now, look, I am a person who does not give credibility to Russia's early attack on Ukraine. At the same time, many progressives and many leftists like to view the Russia-Ukraine war in a very small vacuum. They do not want to acknowledge the fact that there are provable. I mean, this isn't even from, you know, Russian sources. You can, you know, there's British newspapers and international newspapers from other countries that have said, yeah, there's a Nazi problem in the Ukraine. But does that give Russia the right to attack? No. No. And Russia is going to have to ultimately pay for that. How? I don't know. But they're going to have to pay. Back to how some supposed progressives are viewing this. Because on the ground level, or at the grassroots, there's many progressives that really do eye this war with skepticism. Why? Well, you know, first and foremost, we have to acknowledge that there are some people posing as progressives that are more centrist, liberal, conservative types. And a liberal can be conservative, y'all. just a quick point. One of the interesting revelations in Dr. King's Beyond Vietnam speech that I always found funky, not in a bad way, by the way, was the fact that he, when listing his, when listing ideologies at one point, he said revolutionary and conservative. He did not include liberal. Okay, liberals can be very conservative. I mean, you've talked about this. So, you know, just remember that. But many of these people are more liberal conservative than they are progressive left. Additionally, many, there's a couple of them, being paid by some pretty sweet benefactors who have a more probably conservative or libertarian bent to their presentation. And so those people call the shots. And if those people say, we're not supporting Ukraine, those people are not going to be supporting Ukraine. And the folks I'm talking about know that I'm talking about them right now. Not the wealthy people, but the people getting paid by the wealthy people. You know who you are. Aside from all that, and the obvious, okay, Russia's been spending a couple $1 million on some Facebook ads and stuff to, you know, tilt American opinion away from Ukraine towards Russia, which is kind of laughable because, you know, the amount of money, even if it's targeted, you know, $1 million targeted isn't as much money as I think some people think, but amount of money that it would really take to do that would be a bit more than $1 million, maybe a couple billion. Yeah, a couple billion would probably do it. So maybe they're spending a couple billion, and the numbers that I've heard were just incorrect. But aside from all that, and all that stuff makes a dent in opinions. What I have said to some other people in my life who have talked about this, and what I want to now convey to you, is a reality that most people forget. Many progressives that you are seeing who have been on the internet for a long time, they're a little older. And they started really broadcasting in the last 15 years. Maybe 16. But mostly 15. And most of them, you know, around 13. Most of them around 13. Meaning what? Well, depending on their age, and a lot of these people are late 30s through 40s, into their early to mid 50s. What's going on, Brother Sam Cedar? And many of these people really started becoming politicized because of George W. Bush. And they became politicized because of George W. Bush, because of Afghanistan. I'm sorry, not Afghanistan. The one country, I literally just thought to myself, like, do not say Afghanistan, because it's not Afghanistan. Iraq. They became politically active because of Iraq. And the lies that were told in order to get the United States into Iraq. Now, there's going to be those who want to dismiss this and say, well, that was so many years ago, and their skepticism was only enhanced when Libya occurred. Okay? Moreover, there was talk of potential war in the Ukraine as far back as, what, 2013, 2012? It didn't go anywhere, but it was still there. So you have especially people who are under the age of 50. You have a lot of these people who are just skeptical. And they're skeptical because of all of the things that have been done to lie to them about wars that the United States wanted to get into. I mean, this goes even back to Clinton, but, you know, I think there's less there's less reason to revisit a lot of those. Because so many people who are broadcasting today on YouTube and what have you, their politicization happened because of Bush in Iraq. So you have to contend with that. And I know there's a lot of progressives, Tom Hartman, I'm looking at you, who don't want to contend with that. You want to say, look, it's just the intelligence agencies say that it's all Russia, Russia, Russia. Well, Tom, I appreciate that. The problem is, this is the same intelligence group that throughout the Cold War couldn't believe that a bunch of colonies that had been fighting for independence would want to become something other than a colonial capitalist system which had oppressed it. So they started moving towards socialism and communism. Now, of course, the astute person would say, that was so long ago, you're talking about a different intelligence agency. Really? Really? The same people who tell us AFRICOM exists for the benefit of Africa? When nobody believes that. The same people who tell us that the coups that the United States are still orchestrating are for the benefit of the people? Nobody believes that. And what I'm saying is this. Yes, yes. There are reasons to support Ukraine. But there are reasons to doubt that you should support Ukraine. And I think the problem with so many people is that they want to so believe in the general goodness of this country and all of its institutions, including its intelligence institutions. I go through that, where it becomes impossible to think for one second that, wait, people who are skeptical about this stuff may just be right to be skeptical. I get it. I get why it's hard. I mean, especially for a person like Tom Hartman, person who I love his show. You know, I've played a lot of his clips here, and I will continue to play a lot of clips. There's a reason his show has been, if not the top, then among the top-rated progressive shows throughout the country for nearly two decades. Actually, it might be two decades now. It's because he's brilliant, and he's funny, and he's witty, and he's engaging, and he's all of these things. But there's a problem with Tom Hartman's generation that is never mentioned. Their generation spent so much of their lives fighting the Cold War. Russia as the enemy. And yes, Tom went to Russia. I know he's talked about it multiple times. But it became almost a rite of passage and a checkmark to prove that you were a real American, or at least not altogether a wasted American, to say Russia was the bad guy. Russia could do no right. Russia, horrible Russia. And that's part of this wall that needs scaling when we talk about this stuff. Moreover, there is still people within the intelligence apparatus that have yet to retire and throughout government altogether that still remember the end of the Cold War. You know, they were there when the Cold War ended, and they still have that mentality of, we still want to go to war with Russia. And that's a dangerous mentality. Moreover, and I was talking with somebody, and they actually mentioned this, and I forgot all about this. In 2016, there were rumors. I don't know if the rumors were even true, but there were rumors that flew all around the internet that one of the things Hillary Clinton wanted to do if she became president was to either enter a conflict with Russia or encourage a conflict between Russia and one of the former countries that used to be behind the Iron Curtain. Even though that faded away rather quickly, it was still there for a little bit in 2016. I don't believe it was true, but it was still there. And there are some people, I believe, that still remember it. This is a difficult one. And I have tried to remain almost neutral to it. Even though watching what Russia is doing has made it very difficult to be like, well, Russia has, because look, to be honest with you, you know, I was watching a lot of Putin's statements, and I could see reasonable explanation for every statement he gave, including the one about NATO and what have you. Now, I know there's people out there who just want to dismiss all that. Oh, he's just this, he's just that. One of the things I had to come to terms with is Russia is a huge country. To give you an idea of exactly how big Russia is, because none of y'all really understand how big Russia is. And I mean that. You look at it on a map, but how many of you have actually Googled how many square miles Russia is? And not only how many square miles is Russia, how many square kilometers is Russia? Well, let me help you out with that. Russia is 6.6 million square miles. 6.6 million square miles, or 16.37 square kilometers. To give you an idea of how big that is, the United States would have to absorb all of Central America, and what, a third of South America? Maybe half of South America to equal that. Additionally, Russia has a very complex, a much more complex political system than the United States does. I'm not going to get into it here, but I was actually fascinated with it about 7 years ago because of It is a country with countries, with political divisions among among political divisions among. I mean, it's very complex structurally. Yet it is less dynamic than the United States governing structure. I say all of this to say this. There's a lot of, just like in the United States, there's a lot of different constituencies that a president has to appeal to, or a prime minister. And so what I begin to see Putin's various statements about the war as was his attempt to appeal to various constituencies, no different than a president of the United States trying to appeal to various constituencies when he wants to do certain actions. Now, again, this does not excuse Russia's bombing of the Ukraine. It doesn't. It's just in an attempt to understand how this occurred so possibly we can stop it from happening in the future. This is part of what I had to go through. This is part of the thinking process. And I feel like I have to continuously tell you this because some of you do not, you may not want to believe it. You just, oh, well, you're defending Russia a lot. No, I'm not. No, I'm not. At the end of the day, stopping the bombing in Ukraine is of the utmost importance. Healing the lives of those people is of the utmost importance. However, so isn't stopping the wars that are being promulgated throughout Africa by AFRICOM so that resources can be extracted, and healing those people's lives are of the utmost importance. Ukraine is seen as vitally important to the world because it is in Europe. And that's a fact that also has to be contended with. Which leads me to the subject that has pushed me to record this episode, which is what occurred in Gaza. The attack by Hamas. Every human life is precious. 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 Every human life. Why do I keep saying that? I hear some of you rolling your eyes. Oh, you're going to equate what happened in Israel with what happened in Gaza. You're damn right I am. And if you want to roll your eyes at something, roll it at the fact that you do not think that every human life is precious. The reality is this. What Hamas did was wrong. But was it not predictable? Was it not predictable? Reports have come out stating that Egyptian intelligence agencies warned Israeli agencies. Israel is considered one of the top-notch intelligence agencies in the world. In the world. And they ignored this warning to devastating and mournful effects. Am I blaming Israel then for the attack? No, I'm stating a fact. I'm stating a fact. Let me state another one. When you have a group of people who are herded, H-E-R-D-E-D, into a very enclosed pin called the Gaza Strip, they are abused, they are mistreated, they are terrorized by a country that is supported by Western imperial might. And they are left defenseless against this might. Sooner or later, explosions will happen. It is only natural. Now, should I condemn the killing of Israeli citizens, innocent citizens? Yes, obviously. But should I also condemn the killing of innocent Palestinians by Israeli military people who do not have to do the things they do? Hell yes. And if you don't do it, you're the problem, not me. In the black community, we are often attacked professionally, verbally. We are terrorized by Zionist groups when we try to speak up even a little bit for the rights and human dignity of Palestinian people. Why? Because Zionist folks know this. If black people start putting their moral compass into the arena, the international arena, and we push that arrow of human ethics toward the Palestinians and say they are being mistreated by an Israeli government because the West allows the Israeli government to do that, overnight, the conversation changes. Overnight, the conversation changes. Young people a few years ago started talking about BDS, boycott, divest, and sanction Israel. The moment that started, and it picked up steam quickly because it was young people, you saw state after state after state, liberal and conservative, passing laws eliminating the idea of BDS, chastising people and threatening them, not with, well, if you do this, you're going to go to jail. No, it was, they put in sly language that would allow for certain institutions within the United States to kind of paint them in a way that might make it hard for them to get ahead professionally or get certain jobs or what have you. All based on the idea that Israel should never be held accountable for anything it does to the Palestinians. As it was pointed out by one of the YouTubers that have been following this for years. And not just like at the edges either. Talking with folks who have been on the ground in Israel, talking to investigators who have done work investigating war crimes of Israel, investigating the state of the Palestinian population within the borders of what they hope to make all of Israel. As this person pointed out, the Israeli government loves Hamas. They love Hamas being in power. They hated the PLO. Why? Because the PLO sought real, legitimate recognition from the international bodies to move towards building a legitimate Palestinian state. Hamas can be demonized as unforgivably terrible. And they're terrible because they refuse to do ... We'll give a list. In other words, it's beneficial for Hamas to be in power, and Hamas just committed an act which will now bring down the butcher's handle on every head of living in what remains of Palestine. I am asked to condemn what Hamas did, but should I not condemn what Israel has done? And if you ask me, therefore, well, wait a minute, are you saying that the Israelis deserve this? I want to know what you mean by deserve this. Did they bring it upon themselves? What do you mean by that? I said earlier that it was predictable. Because it was predictable. It was predictable. Sooner or later, terrorizing all those people, and I just found out that, because I knew the population in Palestine was quite young, I didn't realize that, like, the median age was under 25. You have a lot of people living with no hope. And you have a Israeli government that has dedicated its forces to not only making sure that these young people continue to not have hope, but they feel inadequate in many ways, and they are terrorized. What do you think they're going to do? The Israelis have socialized medicine, by the way, and sponsored in part by the United States federal government, thank you very much. We can't get it, but they can get it. They have some of the greatest psychological minds working in Israel and throughout the world who are Jewish and can go to Israel. There is no heck in the way that they did not know that sooner or later something like this was going to happen. It had to have happened. So again, you may wonder, well, wait, are you blaming them? I am blaming the history of all of this, which I want to make a stark point that is never made when we talk about this conflict. And actually, no, I apologize. It is partially made. Thank you to the Majority Report. They partially make this point. The creation of Israel was due in part, significantly, to a mandate from the British Empire. Now that mandate came from the UN, but the British Empire, which controlled that region, signed off on it. Israel was created by the last vestiges of overt Eurocentric colonization. Overt Eurocentric colonization, meaning what? What? We don't ask the questions, if not for this, would X, Y, and Z be possible? Because we often know the answer. And then it makes the world a little bit more difficult, because when you seek to address the problems and establish justice, then you start from that question, you start from the reality created by the failure of that question to be interpreted correctly in real time at the moment of the events that you're questioning. And then you have to adjust the situation accordingly. Accordingly. The world put the Jews there to give them a homeland. Awesome. Wonderful. Wonderful. They did that. But they did it on top of the culture and the people that were already there. I do not want the state of Israel to collapse, which, by the way, those of you who've never seen the documentary Peace, Propaganda, and the Holy Land, do it. Never been refuted. It's a beautiful presentation, and it'll shock your mind. It's older. It's significantly older, but it'll shock your mind. I don't want the collapsing of the Israeli state, but retracting it back to the borders from, I think it's, I can't even remember the name of the war now. It was back in the 60s, this is late 60s, early 70s. Can't remember the name of the war. I apologize. Usually I can, right there, just comes right out, but this time for some reason it's not. But pull them back to those borders and give the Palestinians their right to life. I mean, looking at what's occurring, you're watching an imperial endeavor, a colonial endeavor, to strip the Palestinians of not only their land, but the Israelis have literally taken a lot of the, if not all of it now, the fresh water places where the Palestinians could get good water, and all the fertile land that they could get their hands on, and they're currently depriving people of fertile land. I mean, it's an imperial conquest. It is. Again, this does not excuse what Hamas did. But again, it was predictable. You can't keep doing the things that they have been doing, Israelis have been doing to Palestinian people, without there finally being pushback, blowback. They were put there to be a watchdog for the West. They are not a democracy. They are there as part of the Eurocentric hegemon. That's why Israel's in the Middle East. That's why they're there. In my heart of hearts, I hope that there can be peace there. But it's almost an impossibility so long as not only do Palestinians not have any rights, but Israelis refuse to give them land to grow those rights on. My heart really does go out to the folks in Israel. And my heart goes out to the people in Palestine. This is a mess, begun by imperial powers in Europe, egged on by Zionist people throughout the world. I want to address one more thing before I close today. There seems to be confusion among older people when they listen to younger people talk so vehemently in support of the Palestinian people. I have heard older people say, I don't understand why these young people so anti-Israel. They don't say anti-Israel, though. They say anti-Semitic. Why are they so anti-Semitic? Why do they not like Jews? And I've had to tell them. The problem is that you keep thinking people don't like these folks because they're Jewish. Have nothing to do with them being Jewish. Has to do with them being supporters of terrorizing another group, colonizing their land for imperial purposes. Has nothing to do with them being Jews. They're not anti-Israel because Israel happens to be a place where Jewish people live. They're anti-Israel because Israel happens to be a place where imperialist colonizers live who are oppressing a population that has been there for at least 1,500 years, maybe a little bit under that. But I really believe it's over 1,500 years. Now, this new generation is going to resolve this, which is why I believe so much emphasis is going to grow Israel as quick as it can, because you have a new generation of not only people in the United States, but Jewish people who are starting to say, we don't want to kill Palestinians and abuse them anymore. I hope that rules the day. Because if not, the region really right now is marching towards a major conflict with Israel at the center of it. And with all my might, I don't want that to happen. Because it could spin out of control pretty quickly. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, you can always reach out to me. I am your brother, Vladimir Diesel Guy. I'm going to forego listing the left media sources today. Please check me out at radio4al.net. I am publishing exclusively there now. They're great people. Support their project. Go to radio4al.net. You can click into any of the shows. Just type in Class War Batterville Podcast right in the search bar. Click into one of the shows. You can contact me. Just hit contact contributor, and it'll come right to me. Follow me on Facebook, Class War Batterville Podcast. On Twitter, it's my name. Just there's a thumbnail that comes with this. If you get the thumbnail and look at it, all the information to contact me directly is there. If you like the work that I'm doing, please contribute a little bit to the show. $2, $5, $10, $20, $30, $50, whatever you can do. Just send that to CWB Podcast, CWB Podcast, CWB Podcast, Cash App, PayPal. Cash App, PayPal. Big up to Dr. Obtashaka, Professional Left Podcast, Karen Hunter, In Class with Carr, Dr. Greg Carr, Roland Martin, and Best of the Left Podcast. There's a bunch more, but again, not going to really spend time doing that. With much love in my heart, y'all, pray for this world. I'm your brother, Brian Maritese. Oh, God, yeah. And I've been waiting for something to happen for a week or a month or a year. Love y'all. There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again. How the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends?
these governments are killing their own, or the people who find they can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun.